Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Gawen Dawson. He is professor of Victorian literature and culture at the University of Leicester and honorary research fellow at the Natural History Museum, London. And we're talking about his new book, Monkey to Man, The Evolution of the March of Progress Image. Gawen, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you.
What brought you to writing this book?
One thing is that it's an image that you just see everywhere.
We were just talking off mic. I see a cartoon based on this image, I think, every week.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of on the internet, it's absolutely everywhere. So for years and years, I'd seen this image, and I just thought, kind of, where does that come from? But actually, the real start is, my trade, I suppose, is I'm a cultural historian of science, but particularly of the 19th century. And I was looking at some letters between a very famous 19th century scientist, a guy called T.H. Huxley, who was one of Darwin's closest friends and one of his kind of foremost supporters, and an artist that Huxley worked with, a man called Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins. And people knew that they'd worked together and had produced together this image that was the kind of prototype of the March of Progress, this kind of series of skeletons going from a gibbon up to a human. And the assumption had been that they'd worked on it together and agreed and everything. And I found some letters that suggested that they really didn't like each other.
And actually, there were several cases where the artists and the scientists really hate each other.
Absolutely. I think I find things like that interesting, where people don't get on. I find it rather boring, where it's this kind of more kind of sedate thing where everybody gets on. They really hated each other, so there are no letters between them, but letters to other people where they're talking about them, and they really let loose. And I mean, Huxley talks about working with Hawkins as being like in hell, basically. This image, the frontispiece to Huxley's book called Man's Place in Nature, which is the first scientific book about human evolution from the 1860s, it's become a very kind of famous image. It's the prototype of this later March of Progress, one from the 1960s. But actually, it was produced by people who didn't get on. But more importantly, that Hawkins actually really disagreed with evolution. This was part of his animus against Huxley, but not the only part of it. But he was massively opposed to the idea that humans had any shared ancestry with apes. And yet, this was his kind of image. He'd drawn the ape skeletons on this image that kind of perhaps more than any other made that argument that suggested that. So I was immediately intrigued, and I suppose it set me off on a bit of a detective story.
And it's a fascinating one. And that's what's interesting about this book is a lot of people will tell the science part, but because he includes the lives of the artists and the relationship to the scientists, but also the social milieu, and some of the social implications of these images, the story becomes really complex and fascinating. Just to be sure, so the audience all knows we're on the same page, let's talk about the Time Life book from the book Early Man, 1965. The image we're ultimately going to be talking about, and we may not get there because we may stay with the early stuff, but it's a linear progression. That's important.
Yeah.
It's a linear progression from like some primitive, pre-Gibbon, and then it leads in a single line all the way up to the crown of creation, man. And that's the image that stuck with people. And I think today, even people who think they're on the side of evolution think that that's a good image to represent evolution. And I want to, and you make this very clear in the beginning of the book, that's not a good image of evolution at all.
No, absolutely. And the thing is, the scientists nowadays, generally, they're the people who really hate this image the most. I mean, most famously, Stephen Jay Gould, the famous Harvard biologist and journalist and all that, he really thought that it completely misrepresented evolution, and kind of he also worried that it had come to define evolution and to say that evolution was, number one, all about progress, progress in a straight line, and a progress that ends with kind of us guys, with humans as the end point, the goal of evolution. And that, that this has kind of, it's not only scientifically wrong, but it also has some really quite bad problems in making us assume that the kind of the world, the natural world, was made for us, that we could do with it whatever we want, which is kind of where we are with the climate crisis. So he kind of felt that it was all tied in.
It is amazing. A more modern image would be a bush.
Absolutely,
A cladistic one. It's not like there's like one creature that's better than the other one, and it's not following in. So you know, behind us is not an ape, in the same sense of the apes that are alive today. There are all different branches, and we're finding out more branches of hominids as we go along in the fossil history. So it's a complex sort of bush with all sorts of endpoints to it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and to be honest. Darwin himself, back in the kind of the 1850s, he was publishing images that looked like that.
Yep.
The problem is that they didn't catch on. And this is the image that really did catch on and still has its power, whether it's on the internet, on TV, or as graffiti, as political cartoons, all those kind of things. And I think kind of part of the story that I'm telling is how that came to be, it became quite so popular. And it does in part go back to that Time Life book that, Time Life, and I have to confess I'm a bit too young for this and in the wrong country. I'm in the UK, so I didn't really know how important Time Life publications were.
They were huge. And first of all, I lived through that time period, and I have my original copy of that book.
It's literally millions and millions of copies because they would mail them out. It was kind of subscription order.
Yep.
But at the same time, they also invested, because you couldn't buy the books in bookshops, they invested tons of money in advertising and to advertise particularly that book, Early Man, but also other Time Life publications. They used this what was becoming a very famous image. So it was being replicated not just in the book, and it was also being given to school children, to teachers, Time Life were doing that to for their own marketing purposes, but saying, why don't you put this up in your school?
Well, the thing is, it's a great image because it's a big, it's a fold-out. I think it's a five-page fold-out. And you know, while you're talking about why the people still find this image so appealing, it's like a novel. It has an ending. You know, it's got a beginning, it's got a middle, and it's got a dramatic conclusion. I swear that's why people are so sort of fascinated by this idea of evolution, this image of evolution.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that it has that real thrusting sense of narrative.
Yep.
Whereas if you think, scientists have been producing these kind of bush-like alternatives, these cladograms, for decades and decades. But I think you're absolutely right. The narrative that they tell is perhaps not as interesting a one.
Well, it's complicated.
The public, and it's not as clear either.
And we're not top dog.
No, absolutely.
See, that's the other part of it.
That's the kind of story we don't want to hear.
Right. Well, let's go back to the beginning. First of all, let's talk about who Thomas Henry Huxley was.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So Huxley was I suppose in modern terms he'd be called a biologist, but a lot of these terms hadn't developed at the time. But he was kind of from a fairly ordinary background, and he needed to really make a career for himself. And this isn't to suggest that he does this completely cynically, but it becomes part of kind of Darwin's set as Darwin is developing his idea of evolution by natural selection. And Huxley, who doesn't agree with it entirely, but he sees what a brilliant argument it is and what an exceptional way of explaining lots of phenomena in the natural world. And Darwin, in his very famous book On the Origin of Species, which came out in 1859, he doesn't talk about humans. He talks about lots of different creatures and how they evolved and how the process of speciation, species coming to being. But he's very reluctant to apply this to humans. And in part, it's because that's the really controversial element of what he's saying, that we're not made in the image of God, but we're actually evolved from ape-like ancestors. Huxley's a much more, not so much confident, but brash, I think is the right word. He's a man who's he's younger than Darwin, and he's willing to have arguments and to take up Darwin's cause, and that's exactly what he does. And he publishes his own book as a kind of follow-on from On the Origin of Species, which is Man's Place in Nature, in which he precisely applies evolution to human beings. And he it's very much a book about comparative anatomy. So he compares the anatomy of anthropoid apes, that's kind of gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans and gibbons, to humans. And he finds that in virtually every respect, we're almost identical, and that the only rational way of really kind of responding to that is to see us as having an evolutionary relationship. Not that we're evolved from those particular apes, but that we're cousins to them, that we're evolved from the same ancestors in this very long process of evolution. I mean, and it's still a controversial idea in many parts of the world now, and it was incredibly controversial in the mid-19th century in mid-Victorian Britain. And it came to be kind of symbolized by the frontispiece to Huxley's book, in which he had a row of primates going from gibbon up to gorilla and then ending with a human.
The essential, if I can stop you for a second, the essential element is it's a row. It's a line.
Yeah.
That's the thing that sets off everybody. And it starts with gibbon and it ends with?
You get a gorilla as the final ape and then a human.
Yeah.
And also that because they're done at an accurate scale. They each grow kind of little by little, and so you get this kind of upward curve in the image. So immediately you can see that there's a kind of a sense of progress there, and because Huxley is talking about kind of evolution, even though that wasn't what Darwin was arguing for, and it wasn't really what Huxley was arguing for either. But it was inevitable that kind of iconography immediately gave that idea.
But now let's introduce Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins.
Yeah.
How does he get involved in this?
So Hawkins is he's a natural history artist, and he'd actually had a real success about a decade before. In 1851, the high point of kind of Victorian Britain and its world power was something called the Great Exhibition at the Crystal Palace in Hyde Park. This display of the industry of Victorian Britain and all its kind of imperial raw materials and things like that. It was a massive success, and it really started that trend for world trade and exhibitions and things like that we still have today. But anyway, after it closed down, they decided to reopen the Crystal Palace, this enormous building of glass and steel, in the outskirts of London. And Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins was employed to create concrete models of dinosaurs that had only recently been discovered. And the thing is, they're still there in South London. The rest of the Crystal Palace burned down in the 1930s, but these concrete dinosaurs are still there. So if you ever get to go to South London,
they look a little funky.
Yeah.
If you're thinking our modern idea of what dinosaurs look like, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, you are, absolutely. They're quadrupedal rather than bipedal, although it's actually Hawkins, who spent much of his career in America, who, when he comes to America, he's the first person to really articulate dinosaur bones in that bipedal, i.e. on 2 feet pose, and he did that in Philadelphia. So he's not a complete kind of person who thinks of dinosaurs only in that very, very old-fashioned way. He's really, really important. But he's totally opposed to evolution. And when Darwin's book is published, he kind of reads it and shakes his head and gives lots of lectures. And his particular kind of thing is to disprove any sense that humans have any relation to gorillas, that our anatomies are similar at all. And it's not entirely clear why he comes to work for Huxley, but he's a man who needs money.
I was going to say, he was in need of cash, and he not only had a cash flow problem, but apparently he had two families.
He did. I mean, actually, it's not that uncommon for well-to-do men in Victorian Britain.
Wow.
To actually kind of be bigamists. Wilkie Collins, the famous novelist, a friend of Charles Dickens, was in a very similar position. But anyway, he had two families, two wives.
So he needed them. He needed the cash, and but he was also known as a great artist of apes, and he had done drawings of skeletons from the Hunterian Museum.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a top guy to get, but it still is surprising when you know that context. Number one, that he was willing to work for Huxley and to have his kind of artistic attribution in Huxley's book. And there is no smoking gun, but one can assume that he must have done it for the money, because he talks about being precisely this time being greatly in debt and having, I think it was, five unmarried daughters that he has to support. And he also then becomes estranged from both wives, which is one of the reasons why he goes to America in the 1860s. So he's, again, one of these kind of really kind of interesting and really peculiar characters who's behind these iconic images.
But he's creating this drawing that's the frontispiece for Huxley's book. And there's some real problems with it. First of all, the scale is sort of a little bit funky. And aren't they all shown erect, so that they're sort of walking on two legs?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the reason for doing that is that you can then, because it's a book about comparative anatomy, you can then compare their anatomies, their bones, their skeletons, with the human who's shown in a kind of human pose. But this is at a time when there are arguments as to whether gorillas and chimpanzees, how they walk, and if they walk kind of upright. It's also at a time when there aren't that many gorillas or chimpanzees in the Western world. So they come from kind of West Africa, and it's only really at the beginning of the 19th century that in London, for instance, that there are a number of specimens that people can look at. So there's a lot of, and very few lie, there were no live gorillas in Europe until really the 1870s. And so people had to kind of, either from travelers' tales or from the bones, you had to infer how they would walk and their gait as they were standing, so how they should be articulated as a skeleton. So there's a lot of inference going on there.
And Hawkins was the first British artist to draw an anthropoid ape from life. He drew a chimpanzee.
Yeah. Okay. So this is something that I think I've found. So in the past, there are lots of, say, from the late 17th century into the 18th century, there are lots of engravings of chimpanzees, and it's pretty clear that what has happened is that the artist, because those few chimpanzees, and actually it's clear that that this was part of the roots of transatlantic slavery, that they would come across to Britain on that triangular route of the slave trade in the 17th century. And when they, if they did arrive in Britain or in Paris, elsewhere in Europe, often they would catch diseases and die very, very quickly. And so artists only had the bones and at best some skin to work with. But because you wanted to make your pictures interesting, you would revivify them. You would make them look as if they were living. But I think Hawkins is the first British artist to really kind of meet a living chimpanzee, which he does in the London Zoological Gardens in 1835. A lovely chimpanzee by all accounts, who was called Tommy, who lived only for a few months, but even in those few months was the talk of the town, and all these artists turned up. And Hawkins, I think, was the very first one. And in my book, I reproduce a lithograph
Oh, it's beautiful.
Which is really quite kind of affecting, because he's depicted in kind of human terms as like a child. It's dressed up and sentimentalized as well. But I do think that Hawkins is the first British artist to ever draw an anthropoid ape from the life.
It's amazing. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Gawen Dawson, Professor of Victorian Literature and Culture at the University of Leicester and Honorary Research Fellow at the Natural History Museum, London. And we're talking about his book. It is a fascinating book about art, society, and science. Monkey to Man, The Evolution of the March of Progress Image. We're going to run out of time before we get out of them. The most amazing thing is how deeply Hawkins hated Huxley. He loathes him. He really hates him. And every turn, if it's possible, he'll denigrate him some way.
Yeah, he kind of sees them as being in an intellectual duel. One of the things about Hawkins is that he thinks he knows as much, if not more, than people like Darwin and Huxley. And he thinks that actually he should have just as much right to say what he thinks. And to be honest, I think Huxley is rather unfair to him and is very dismissive and sniffy. He doesn't see him as having proper scientific knowledge. And so Hawkins, through the rest of his life, and he lives into his 80s, makes these drawings where he's really kind of echoing and reproducing the frontispiece to Man's Place in Nature that he had drawn, but to put over his own views about apes and humans having no anatomical kind of resemblance whatsoever. So, and in his letters, he describes this as being kind of, he uses the metaphor of a duel, that they're almost kind of pistols at dawn with each other. Huxley is just continues to be dismissive of him, but for Hawkins, it's a hatred that lasts right up until the end of his life.
The fascinating thing is this starts a whole line of discussion about evolution and, unfortunately, race, that then where you get this linear progression and perfection of evolution. And when you bring what they called race at that point in time, that's where things get really dark and weird, especially with people like the German naturalist Ernst Haeckel.
Yeah.
In his book.
Absolutely.
That's just brutal.
It is. And I have to say, I pondered long and hard as to whether to include some of the images that I do. But I worried that it would be to sanitize this story, that it would be actually to not tell the story properly, to acknowledge the real darkness that is part of this story. And Haeckel, he's a kind of Darwinian, and he's a friend of Darwin and Huxley, but he's much younger than them, and so he lives into the early 20th century. But he's the person who really starts racializing these images, and that sense that you've got a kind of hierarchical progression from apes up to humans, but actually not just a single human. So Huxley's frontispiece, I think, is noticeable for the human skeleton represents humans of all races. That was seen as really quite important in the American Civil War. The book was published during the American Civil War and reprinted in America. And it was embraced and adopted by abolitionists, by people in the North who were really opposed to slavery, and it was seen as being on their side. So it's quite a complicated story in relation to race. But with Haeckel, in Germany, he's the person who adopts Huxley's frontispiece and then connects it to lots of really egregiously racist imagery. But actually, the story again becomes complicated in that in the 1920s and 1930s in New York, this image of linear progress is adopted by a primatologist, a man called William King Gregory, and he's both the mentor but the main intellectual opponent of probably America's most famous evolutionist at this time, a man called Henry Fairfield Osborne. And Osborne was terribly racist.
Terribly.
And in fact, embraced fascism as That's well. Right. But he was opposed to that linear image. He really hated it because he hated the idea that humans had any connection with race.
Right.
So he was an evolutionist, but he had this rather complicated argument that the humans weren't related to apes in any way. Gregory, as both his kind of protege, but actually his intellectual opponent, used different versions of Huxley's image to undermine Osborne's thinking about race. And so actually, whilst with Haeckel, it gets taken into some dark areas. With Gregory, not entirely, but it takes on a new kind of set of meanings and is in fact used to oppose Gregory's kind of more fascist views. And Gregory's imagery is really about parallel lines, so rather than one single kind of line of progress. And he used those parallel lines to suggest that kind of different human races had evolved separately and at different paces, whereas Gregory, although not entirely free from the kind of the casual racism of his time, it has to be said, he used it in much more, for us, what would be progressive ways to undermine fascism and eugenics and thinking about racial selection in those ways. So, I mean, the point I try to make throughout the book is that we can't overlook the really dark kind of areas in relation to race where this story takes us. But it's not a simple story. There are complexities, and the image can be used both to support and to undermine kind of racist arguments.
And we're completely out of time, and we just got started. My guest tonight has been Gowan Dawson. He's professor of Victorian Literature and Culture at the University of Leicester, an honorary research fellow at the Natural History Museum London, and he's written an amazing book, Monkey to Man, The Evolution of the March of Progress Image. If you've ever seen one of those cartoons of that image, you need to read this book. Gowan, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been for me too. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.